everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Comic Source Podcast. This episode is my interview with Jim Zub, comic creator, that I did at Amazing Arizona Comic Con this last weekend. Jim's most high-profile gig coming up for Marvel is his recently announced Thunderbolts series. So we talk about that towards the end, but first it's a long, in-depth interview about Wayward, his creator-owned title from Image that he is putting out with his co-creator, Steve Cummings. It's a really, really great series. I recently caught up on it. And if you're a fan of Japanese culture, manga, things like that, you'll really like this title. It's very rich in history and legacy of Japanese culture. Very well written, extremely well illustrated. Steve Cummings, the illustrator, has really clean lines. He's very good storytelling from panel to panel. The facial expressions, the backgrounds, especially in this book, are amazing. Jim and I talk about that in the interview, so I hope you enjoy the interview, and I definitely recommend picking up Wayward, and I'm looking forward to trying out Thunderbolts and seeing what new take Jim has on that classic Marvel team. Now, please understand that we held this interview on the floor of Amazing Arizona Comic Con, so if you hear background noise and such, I apologize for that. You know, a busy convention, and that's just par for the course as far as that goes. Also, if the interview seems choppy at times, that's because I edited out whenever they did announcements over the loudspeaker overhead, or someone would come up to Jim's table to talk to him. So I know you guys will understand the reason for that. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. All right, this is Jace from the Comic Source. I'm here with comic creator Jim Zub. And we're going to be talking about Wayward.
Yeah.
A book I recently discovered, and it really blew me away. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say I'm not a huge fan of Japanese culture, like I know a lot of people are. I'm not necessarily a manga reader or any of that, but this series, you don't have to be a fan of those kind of things to have this series grab you and be very compelling.
Well, thank you.
So, Jim, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit to start out, maybe give us a quick 30-second pitch. What's the book all about?
So, Wayward is a bit like Buffy in Japan. So, it's teenagers fighting Japanese mythological monsters on the streets of modern Tokyo.
And where did the origin of this idea come from?
Well, it was sort of a fusion of a couple different things. So I had been looking at my first kind of big creator-owned book called Skull Kickers had come out in 2010, and it was doing well, but I wanted to, you know, get another title and get more stories out. And one of the people I'd been talking to is an old friend of mine, you know, Stephen Cummings. And we got along really well when we worked together at the Udon Studio. We thought it would be a good, team up for us to work on a project. And we'd always just, the schedules hadn't aligned for a long time. And when it finally did, I said, you know, I've got this idea about a sort of looking at mythology in the modern world and how it sort of affects us. And Steve had an idea. He really wanted to do a story set in modern Tokyo. That's where he lives. And he loves the city. And he's like, you know, every time I see Tokyo in movies or in any kind of media, it's always like a brutal cliche. It's you know, they're not giving the full sort of sense of depth and breadth to what the city has to offer. So I would love to do something set in Japan. And so my original idea for this mythological story, which it's probably in my head, it was sort of vaguely, you know, Eurocentric, because we think of myth like, you know, dragons and unicorns and things like that. And all of a sudden it just opened up this incredible amount of possibilities, because Japanese myths are incredibly rich and diverse and fascinating. And I already knew some of them, but I got to do a ton of research and really dig in and realize, okay, this is going to be so much more, you know, than I thought it was. So much more engaging, so much more interesting as an idea. And we just started rolling forward with that. So Steve provided a lot of, you know, great knowledge and resources on that front. And then I did a ton of research as well as we were, you know, developing the series.
So really, when you talk about working with your collaborator, Steve, it was really each of you brought
different things to the table, different parts of the whole that it ended up becoming.
Yeah, it really is a pure collaboration, because it wouldn't have existed in this way without both of us. Yeah.
And so even though he's more on the visual side of things, you still, even now, you collaborate with the story ideas and the way the plot is going.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell him sort of my broader plans for where I think it should go, and then he'll, you know, he'll sort of say, oh, I'd love to draw this kind of thing, or it would be great if we set that scene here. You know, most of the locations in Wayward are real places in Tokyo. And so we'll even send like Google Earth links back and forth, like we're casting for a set, you know, like wouldn't this location be great? Or, and if he needs more reference, he'll just go out, grab the train and take some photos, or, you know, make sure that it's all up to date in that way. And not every single scene is in a real spot, but a good chunk of them are. And we didn't just want to choose like iconic, you know, touristy spots. We want to choose like out of the way sort of places, or really interesting kind of off the beaten path sort of options.
How's the How's the reception for the book been so far?
It's been great. I mean, we were a little bit nervous because we're, you know, talking about another country's culture, and we're trying to sort of bring this nuance to this story all about Japan and sort of what we think in terms of the characters and the city and all this sort of stuff. But we really do, you know, do our due diligence to make it as in-depth and really take care to present it, to ground the story in the setting, so that the supernatural stuff feels that much more fantastic when you put it in the real place.
And you were nominated for some awards as well, right?
Yeah, we got some like best of the year kind of awards and things like that from Comics Alliance. The YALSA, which is the American Library Association, has the recommended picks for teenagers. We were one of their recommended picks for 2015 and things like that. So it's very gratifying to have people really respond well to it. And readers, not just in North America, but even overseas, and also even in Japan.
That was going to be my next question. Do you have Japanese readers that are responding to it?
Yeah, absolutely. Steve gets tweets from some of our Japanese readers, and there are stores now, you know, with the rise of the superhero movies and things, there's more and more of what they call Amikami, or American comic kind of fan bases, starting to crop up more and more in Japan. And so our stuff gets sold in some of those stores. And, you know, Steve's gone to some comic festivals where he's been able to, we have a Japanese doujinshi, which is like a self-published kind of he did it officially, but like a translated version that he sold at some festivals, yeah.
Oh, that's really cool. If you've read the story, one of the main ideas is this tapestry, this idea of fate, or how our lives are all intertwined. It's not necessarily an original idea.
Right.
We've seen it, you know, in movies and stories before. But what I found fascinating about it was it's such a major theme in the book. And granted, as I said, I'm not hugely steeped in Japanese culture or history.
Right.
And I've actually been learning a lot through reading this book. One of the things that Zach Davison talks about in some of the extra material in the back is how in that culture, very different from Western culture, where we have so many choices about how a lot of things are planned out. There is a place for you in the weave, so to speak.
Right, right.
So it's tapestry and allegory as a story.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's one of the themes you're hoping to explore, particularly going forward?
Well, and there is a lot of allegory with the characters. And I don't want to always put it in a... I don't want to have characters saying the theme, you know. But when you look at what... you know, the teenage characters kind of represent the new generation of the supernatural in Japan. And what that sort of means, you know, Japan as a whole is now getting more and more, you know, foreign influence, right? Rory is not just that teenager, she is the foreign influence. She is sort of the changing world, you know, the face of Japan. She's half Japanese, but she also brings all these other influences into it. And so, you know, all the characters have those types of symbols or cultural kind of touchstones as part of their identity that I try and use. So it's tapestry, it's fate, it's this idea of sort of, you know, the transition of generations and how we, as much as we want, you know, our traditions and the things that we think are important to stick around, as we get older, those things get taken from us, you know what I mean? And it's no longer our sort of choice once the next generation takes over.
Right. You've been woven in and you're kind of stuck where you're...
Absolutely.
...where you're at. Another big theme that I feel in the book, there's a trend right now, I feel like. These books that are set in a school setting, we've got Morning Glories, Deadly Class, we've got Gotham Academy over at DC. So it fits in very well with the theme of, okay, a lot of the main characters are young. They do still have choices.
Right.
It's growing and changing as a metaphor for the way we see both technological change and political change and really the physical changes of this planet we live on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is one of the things, is that in a world where, you know, we have access to all this information and we have these incredible, you know, connections now around the world, how do, you know, the traditional ways, how do they have to adapt or how do they change in order to make way for it? Do you know what I mean? And so it's not just about the next generation. It's also about the previous generation kind of having to either embrace or be kind of washed away.
Yeah, that's just hearing you talk about it right now, that very famous quote comes into my head, you know, those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. So you don't just, we can't just move forward and forget where we've come from and the shoulders of the giants that we're standing on to be where we are now.
Right, absolutely. And so it's something where, you know, I think there's a lot to be said about trying to hold on to the things that are important, but equally knowing that other aspects are going to have to evolve. That it's not a simple, and it's not a one or zero. Some stuff is going to be shades of, you know, kind of gray washing through what stays, what goes, or what completely changes. And you see that in terms of our language, you see that in terms of our culture, our priorities, and that's happening, you know, the type of conflict that's happening in Japan is on a huge level where tradition and family and those priorities are even more ingrained into the society, and yet they're going through the same, if not more, of that kind of tumultuous, you know, upheaval.
It's one of the things I love about comics. Here's this great comic, you can read it on the surface, and it's fun, it's colorful, it's exciting, it's a good story, but if you want to get deeper, the levels are there.
Absolutely.
It's one of the things I just love. Let's talk a little more specifically about the story itself.
Sure.
Rory, the main character you mentioned, half Japanese, I believe her dad's Irish.
That's right.
Issue 8 really showed how powerful she really can be.
Yeah, her power, and, you know, in that kind of classic way of she doesn't even, can't fully comprehend it or even be able to control it just yet. But as she gets more and more confidence, you know, you start to realize this is pretty scary stuff, and that there's ramifications for every single one of these times she uses the power in a big way. Absolutely.
And one of the things that struck me, and I'm not fishing for spoilers, I don't
right.
like things to be ruined, but one of the things that struck me was, is it because she's not fully Japanese that she's on such a level? You know, being that her dad is Irish,
right.
again, a culture that is very steeped in folklore.
Absolutely.
Could that possibly be? It's just something that popped up in my head.
All I'll say, and I'm not going to ruin it, obviously, but her being half Irish is not just randomly plucked out of, you know, the
okay.
ether.
Fair so. Enough. I look forward to learning more. Another thing you mentioned about she doesn't even realize how powerful she has become, the ethics of what she's doing, especially
yeah.
when she can affect people's memory.
Mm-hmm.
And
O'Hara's parents
and direct them going forward. Is it right? Yeah. Is it right? Is it okay?
And this is the thing, is that, you know, as much as some people say to me, oh my God, that's terrible, or I can't believe she did that, you've got to keep in mind that this is, you know, a teenager who's going through these tumultuous and terrible things happening and reacting emotionally,
right.
reacting in these big dramatic ways because she doesn't know how to deal with it. And so I think rather than just being, it's easy as a reader to look from the outside and sort of say, well, I would never do that. And you're like, but
you're not
the stakes are so high, and
that,
you know, there's so much going on, and she hasn't even fully had a chance to mourn her mother or any of those sorts of things. And so it's this difficult kind of ride, you know what I mean? That she's being pulled through this intense, tumultuous dramatic thing, and she doesn't know what to do. It's, you know, lashing out or looking for a port in a storm.
Yeah, when I saw it happen, it really struck me just how powerful she is. I certainly didn't judge her for it and think, oh, she's not a good person, because,
right,
like you said, until you're in that position, you really don't know. But it struck me, she's super powerful. I love the fact that Jim's going to be able to explore the, because I'm sure you'll touch on it later, the ethics of, and even
absolutely,
in fact, you already have a little bit, when O'Hara goes back and mm-hmm, realizes
that this terrible, terrible yeah, thing is happening. It doesn't know how, but just reacting emotionally to it. And even Shirai not telling her, because
right,
he doesn't know how to say it. He doesn't know what, you
right,
know,
and but even at the time he didn't necessarily approve, so it's
nope,
it's in the story itself giving the different perspectives,
absolutely,
which is really cool. Let's talk a little bit about the contribution of Zach Davison. As I mentioned, he does a lot of the extra material in the back, mm-hmm, which I love when books do this. You know, comics have gotten expensive, and so when you can get more than just a 5 or 10 or 15 minute read,
improve your value,
yes,
absolutely,
improve your value. There's text pieces in the back exploring Japanese culture, exploring the history. How did you get hooked up with Zach?
Totally lucked out, I gotta admit. So I knew we were gonna have back matter in the comic, and I was really kind of nervous about it because I realized it was gonna be a lot of work to find different people to write about different aspects of Japan. But, you know, I had already started reaching out to start communicating with people, and then we announced the series, and I just absolutely lucked out. So there's a writer named Brandon Seffert. He did Witch Doctor over at Skybound. He did the first Disney Kingdom series for Marvel. He's a friend of mine I've known for quite a while, and as soon as he saw the announcement, he's like, oh my God, there's someone I have to introduce you to. This guy is Zach Davison. And I didn't know it at the time. When I was doing my research, I had bookmarked a whole ton of Zach's articles online, because he has his own website all about yokai and Japanese folklore. And so I already had a bunch of his stuff earmarked, not knowing, you know, that my friend knew him and whatever. And so he put me in touch with Zach and just sort of said, look, you know, Jim's a good guy, he's doing this book. You know, would you be interested in checking out and, you know, seeing what you think? And what I didn't know, I find this all out later, Zach was actually not really thrilled, because he's like, oh, this Caucasian guy is going to try and talk about Japan. This isn't going to, you know, it's going to be like ninjas and, you know, just corny, cliche sort of stuff.
Right.
And so out of his friendship with Brandon, he was like, okay, I'll
now,
check it out.
Is Zach American?
He is, but he lived in Japan for, I think, 9 years.
Okay.
He's a professional translator,
okay,
and he's also a monster scholar. He's written multiple books on Japanese mythology and ghosts and spirits. So he's really steeped in the folklore.
Right.
And so he ended up checking it out. I sent him the outline and the first script, and he emailed me right back after he read it, and he goes, hey, this is great, I'm on board, you know, what do you need me to do? And I said, well, can you write one or two articles? He said, no, I'll write all of them. Don't let anyone else touch it. I know exactly, you know, what you're going for, and I think it's really awesome. This is the book I've been waiting for, you know, let's really dig in. And so he's always been an amazing collaborator, where he brings something great in terms of the, you know, the research material and his additional perspective, but he's never trying to manhandle and tell us which way the story should go.
Right.
He's always additive. So I say, hey, here's what I'm doing, here's why, and then he's like, cool, you know, did you know symbolically this could tie in with this? And I'm like, I was not aware of that. So he's always helping to bring some new perspective, or, you know, sort of helping to point us towards other resources that'll help enhance and really strengthen what's already there. And that's why it's such a great collaboration, because he's able to bring, you know, even more authenticity to what we're trying to deliver in terms of that story.
Yeah, as I mentioned at the top, I'm not a big manga fan, and Steve Cummings' art style, I certainly wouldn't consider it manga.
Right.
But yet, there's a little bit of manga influence, but I'm always a fan of art with really clean lines.
Mm-hmm.
His lines are very clean. Another thing I love about his art is there is a little bit of, you can definitely see the manga influence in the expressions, but also he's so great, maybe one of the best I've ever seen, at not only drawing characters, but the backgrounds.
Oh, his locations are phenomenal, and it's one of the things that I think really helps set the book apart is his ability to, you know, look at these locations, and he's not just like tracing a photograph, he's really staging a scene.
Right.
And he's really making it, the city is one of the characters in the book in a way, that it has, you know, a depth to it and an interest in terms of location. And we're always talking about where to set certain scenes. So I'll usually say, okay, emotionally, here's what's happening, here's the plot. And then he's like, well, I think they could have that happen here. That'd be really interesting visually. So again, that collaborative process. We'll even send Google Earth links back and forth. It's like we're casting, you know, for the set of a movie or something. You know, it's just that feel of, we want that to really come across strongly.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect marriage of the story and his art style, and it's one of the reasons that I love that he's not just the artist, but, you know, he's co-owns it with you.
So yeah,
we know going forward that this incredible quality art is going to be on the book the whole time.
Absolutely. No, and I think it's really important. When you're doing creator-owned, you got to have, it's a passion project.
Right.
That's how these things come about. So you can't just, you know, knock it out. It's got to be something where you're both dedicated and you're both involved at every level, because that's what's going to make something really special. That's what's going to really, you know, come through, I think, to the reader.
Yeah, and we'd be remiss if we didn't also mention the colorist, Tamara
Bombalan. Yeah, Bombalan.
Yeah, amazing job. Really vibrant colors. There's sort of a trend in comics these days to be dark and gritty. Wayward is not that. It's an exciting story. There are dark beats to the story.
Sure.
I'm not saying they're not, but it's a very bright story, very accessible, and I love the tone and the mood that she sets with her colors.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it's really important to get that palette across in terms of mood or in terms of, so, you know, Tamara's ability to sort of take Steve's line art and strengthen it in terms of tone and in terms of mood and in terms of light and shadow is so important to the look of the book. And I think that it really helps, again, just strengthen, you know, the message all the way across. When the, you know, the kids are using their powers, they've each got kind of like their own color palette that really comes out. And I think that, again, it helps brand them and identify them.
And we should also mention Marshall Dillon, the letter.
Oh, yeah. Does Marshall and I have been working together since, like, back in the Street Fighter days. So we've, he's pretty much lettered every creator-owned thing I've done.
Does he do the kanji as well?
He does not. So all the signage in the backgrounds, that's a combination of Steve and I. So Steve will send me the signs, and then I'll drop them in digitally in Photoshop, and then he'll double check them and stuff like that. So on some of the street scenes, it can be pretty extensive, where
right.
I'm sitting there for a couple hours just, you know, scaling and setting up signs in the backgrounds and stuff like that. And it's one of the things I'm really proud of is that, you know, Zach and Steve, they really make sure that that signage is legit. Like, we've had Japanese readers be like, I can't believe, you know, all those signs are, they read properly. And, you know, normally you'd think that it would just be like random.
Yeah, I mean, because it's an American comic, most people reading it
wouldn't be able to tell. But we want to get it right. And I think that's one of the things that's helped set the book apart, is that when it comes to the Japanese stuff, you know, we want to do as good a job as possible at presenting, you know, that world.
Yeah, and that goes right along with what Marshall's doing on the letters. I feel like letters, they don't get, I mean, it used to be the same way with colors, but that's starting to change. But
yeah.
I feel like letters are still in the background. It's something that, if you do it right, no one really notices.
Absolutely, it's
but
invisible.
But if you do it wrong, you know, the sky is falling.
Well, because the storytelling gets all messed up. When you do it wrong, the flow of the page is affected so badly.
Or in the beats of the story could
yep.
not come across correctly.
And so, you know, it's really Marshall's job to kind of, he gets the last sort of attempt to make sure that the clarity is there, you know?
Well, Wayward overall as a story feels very epic to me, and certainly that it, because it's incorporating so much Japanese culture and folklore, and, you know, Japanese culture has a sense of mysticism to it. You know, it always has, much more so maybe than some Western cultures.
I agree to a point. I think one of the cliches, though, is this idea that Japan is so strange and so wild and so bizarre that, you know, we couldn't empathize, or that we, you know,
right.
And I think one of the things that's really important is to realize that these are emotional, you know, human stories first and foremost. Some of the ways that they're reacting to it might be unusual compared to what you're used to in a Western story. I know, but sort of the Neo-Confucianism that drives a lot of traditional Japanese roles in the home or roles at a job, I think they surprise and they kind of confuse North American readers. But at the end of the day, they're still human stories and they're emotional stories, and that's what makes them work.
Early on when I was reading the series, I almost felt like this story idea seems a little bit obvious, mixing the traditional and the folklore
right.
with this new generation and using Japan as the setting for that. How much when you and Steve, you brought your different ideas together and melded them together, how much of it just happened organically, and how much did you really have to work to get those ideas to mesh together?
The toughest thing was not, I mean, all the creatures and the those aspects of it were pretty straightforward because they all exist in the folklore.
Mm-hmm.
The toughest part was coming up with our cast of teenagers because we didn't want them to be just like super-powered superhero kind of teens. I didn't just want to have, you're the kid on fire and you're right. the one that flies or something like that. You know, you're the one that's strong. Like, I wanted to be able to say, okay, each of these characters, their power is informed by a cultural idea or an aspect of Japan that we can kind of emphasize without falling into, you know, grotesque stereotype or something like that.
Right.
So some of them are more subtle and some of them are more broad. But I think as a whole, what's really gratifying is that people have really, you know, attached to them, that people are really enjoying their story. Even someone like Ayane, you know, that in a lot of ways we took the cliche of the anime cat girl and we made a girl of cats, you know, this sort of like spirit creature of cats, and really was able to play up what you could think of as a real heavy-duty cliche and give it a different spin. And I think that's one of, you know, it's a fun bit to play with in a sense that you think you know what this is all about, and then we were able to give it a little bit of a left turn, you know?
One of the things I love about her as a character, you never know what she's going to do next.
No, she's so capricious and she's so, her emotions are kind of on the surface and she's very needy and she's very intense. And when she feels like she's been mistreated or when she feels like something is not going right, she reacts in a very visceral way. And I think, you know, there's a lot of characters, people look at characters and they empathize with them because they see focused aspects of themselves
right.
either as who they are or who they want to be. And those types of characters who are very intensive and very hard on their sleeve or, you know, immediately charging forward into the fray, a lot of people love those characters because they represent those qualities that they wish they had in their own behavior, that they didn't back down, that they, you know, charged forward, defended their friends, even potentially, you know, going a little too fast,
right.
a little too dangerously, but doing it because it's what you think is right.
Yeah, and very relatable nowadays with the whole instant gratification. I mean, that's
Absolutely.
Something that a lot of the older generation look down on the younger generation for.
Oh, totally. And I think it's something interesting about, again, dealing with Japan as a place where you have a culture that's very much known for patience and care and not rushing headlong into things. But you look at the new generation in Japan and there's a desire to bring some more of that kind of Western spontaneity into it. And what that does and how that changes how you look at, you know, your own history or your own goals.
So how far, is this a finite story? Can you keep telling stories forever? What are your future plans for Rover?
It's finite in the sense that we have an ending plan. I don't have an exact number of issues. We've got a bunch of really cool pieces now in play, and I love the idea that we're going to be able to explore some of them. And I've got the main story outlined, but I leave certain sort of elements. You want to be able to work with spontaneity. If a great idea comes about, you don't want to be kind of stuck,
right.
unable to work with it.
Stuck in the tapestry already.
Yeah, essentially. So we want to leave ourselves a little bit of headway to have fun with, you know, unexpected happy accidents in right. terms of storytelling.
Yeah, or, I mean, let it grow organically. That's
right, but that doesn't mean you don't have a plan.
Right.
Because if you go in without a plan, then it's just going to be haphazard.
Right.
You know? And so it's sort of a mixture of those two things where I say, okay, here are the big, broad story beats that we're trying to achieve. And then within the scope of that, if certain things work better than we thought or certain things aren't working, we can sort of throttle and adjust from there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great story.
Thank you.
I really think, listeners, if you're not picking it up, go out, pick up a trade, first trade. It's really cool. I did want to talk just very briefly. You have an upcoming project with Marvel.
Yes.
Bringing the Thunderbolts back.
That's
in
right.
New iteration. How much is that going to hold to the previous iterations, I guess, the previous versions of Thunderbolts? Is this an all-new start, or some of the same themes?
The overarching idea of Thunderbolts, if you want to look at, you know, this idea of bad people doing good things, maybe for the wrong or right reasons, do you know what I mean? I think holds true, and I think it's one of those ideas that holds the series together, regardless of who's on the team. And so I think that that's going to hold true. Now, the team itself has got some, you know, quite a few of the classic characters from the original Busick run, but they're now being led by, you know, Winter Soldier, and his goals and his desires for the team are really going to fuel, you know, both the good and the bad of what's coming, the conflict that they're going to be getting themselves into, and even his own sort of doubts about whether or not he can cohesively run this group and keep them, I don't want to say the straight and narrow, because it's not like he's always morally on the up and up either.
Yeah, I mean, he's not somebody I necessarily think of as a team player or a team leader.
And that's one of the difficult things, is he now has this responsibility that he's got to take on and try and forge this group into something good. But what that means and how that comes about and whether or not they're successful, that's all going to be, you know, up in the air.
Now, how did you come to be on Thunderbolts? Did they approach you?
I had been in touch with, you know, in Marvel. I did the Figment series for them, the Disney Marvel team up, you know, Figment series with Bill Roseman. And then he got a promotion and moved to the West Coast to head up Marvel Games. But he put in a really good word with several other editors at Marvel for me, because he knew I wanted to get in, you know, to the Marvel Universe and do some superhero stuff. And it took a while to kind of find the right fit and the right project. But Tom Brevoort, you know, who runs the Avengers group, dropped me a line and asked me if I would be interested in the Thunderbolts and if I wanted to put in a pitch. And it was that simple. So, I mean, you know, the good thing is I had built up a reputation for being, you know, dependable and doing good work. And so he was willing to give me a chance to come up with, here's how I would do it, you know, based on several other things that they were building in terms of overall Avengers plot. And thankfully it hit the mark, you know. So I'm now, yeah, cranking away in terms of, the first script is done, and I'm plugging away on sort of the overarching story for the first chunk of issues, and how it also reflects and ties into some of the stuff that's coming in Avengers and Captain America.
Was it your idea to have Winter Soldier on the team, or did that come from?
That was already set, so that was something that they had in mind. I guess it had been figured out at one of their story summits, and then it was just a matter of how I was going to utilize it. Yeah.
So when you found out, that must have been,
oh, it's pretty
like,
cool.
Oh, that's cool.
It's fascinating.
How am I going to?
Yeah. What's the, you know, what's the game plan?
Right.
And trying to, you know, with any kind of story, you want it always to be ideally surprising, but also appropriate. Like someone goes, oh, I didn't see that coming, but now that it happened,
it makes sense.
It feels totally like the right move.
Right.
And that's always that interesting kind of creative balance you want to strike with the work. And I think that Winter Soldier is an unexpected but appropriate choice, because he has a similar kind of criminal redemptive kind of background.
Right.
And so he's a good fit in terms of the overarching theme, but he's not close to any of them, so there's already conflict built in right from the get-go.
Right. Well, if anybody's interested in purchasing Waiver or find out more information, where's the best place they can go?
Easiest place to find out more about what I'm working on is jimzub.com, so J-I-M-Z-U-B.com. I'm also on Twitter at J-I-M-Z-U-B. and ask me questions. You can find out about my work. And on my website, I also have tutorials about how I write comics, how I pitch, some of the economics of creator-owned comic books, including like full scripts and pitches for some of my creator-owned work.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for your time, Jim.
My pleasure.
And listeners, you better get out there and pick up Wayward. You're missing out if you're not reading it.
Oh, thank you so much.